I guess we finished with Ital, an excerpt from Ital's theme, from Ital's theme's 12-inch single. Ish Phillips and his orchestra recorded live at the Watchung View Inn, Somerville, New Jersey. Music for your house party, that was Moon River. Stephanie Chladowski sang in the month of January from the High High Nest, accompanied by the great Sick to the Back Teeth, an excerpt from a CD entitled King of Creation. J.B. Banfi was thrown in there from some Cosmish Hippie stuff. Galaxy My Dear, the song called Goodbye My Little Star. Dylan Iokas was in there as well from his new Carry On Hut, The Frosted Growth, and other tracks. Pumice from a split 7-inch with Grouper did Twin Neck Double Kick Bum Chin. Belong was a new CD, Common Era, its title. A Walk, the track we heard. Visitations and Big Blood with the great Electric Lashes 7-inch before that. Twin Sister Moon from the Hollow Mountain did the Hollow Mountain. Frankie Rose from a Sacred Bones compilation, Winter 2010 four-song EP. Their cover of Slap Happy's Blue Flowers. Legendary Pink Dots before that from their earliest cassettes, now on a CD issue. It's called Under Triple Moons. We heard Oceans of Emotion. John Bender has had 1982's Pop Surgery now reissued. From it we heard Glass. And we opened that set with 1979 7-inch called Genetic Disruption from the band Murder the Disturbed. Ultimate System was the name of the track. That's everything we heard, everybody. Enjoy your day. My name's Scott. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Thanks for listening. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker is here. Too Much Information is next. Bye-bye.
Oh, yeah, I was calling about the job, man. How's it going?
Fine. Which job were you calling about?
I don't know. I'm looking to reel in some cash, you know. I'm looking for work, man.
Oh, what kind of work do you do?
It's construction. I repair lava lamps, listen to 8-tracks, play bass, you know. What do you guys got over there, man?
None of those, I can tell you right off the bat.
Well, I can do anything, man.
Right at the moment, I don't have anything that is in that particular field. My recommendation would be that you go with a...
Hold on a second.
Okay.
sorry, man. I'm really hungover, man.
Okay.
I gotta stop drinking one of these days. I don't want you guys to think I'm sorry.
$500 and more per week, performing a variety of jobs and crafts for many different companies in the comfort of your own home. You can work full or part-time and at your own pace. These jobs are geared for both men and women. Most companies require absolutely no experience and will supply you with all materials necessary to begin immediately. These national companies are solid and have been around for years, paying out huge sums of money to people just like you. For example, make glamorous hair bows with the materials supplied by this company, and they will pay you up to $374 per week. Work with wood. Earn up to $404 a week assembling wood note holders that take minutes to complete, and you could have a check within 48 hours. These are just a few of over 80 companies ready to offer you home employment. If this idea of working out of your own home is appealing to you and you are eager to get started, we will provide you with The Road to Home Employment, a complete home employment guide, which will tell you who these companies are and how to contact them, a brief description of the job, and the estimated amount of money you could make. Order The Road to Home Employment for the low price of $19.95, plus $5 shipping and handling, and start down the path of financial freedom. This is a no-risk offer. If you are not completely satisfied, send back the guide within 60 days for a full refund. Just leave your name, address, and zip code clearly after the tone. Be sure to speak slowly and spell any difficult words. Your guide will arrive in 3 to 4 business days. Order now.
After you have finished recording, press the pound sign for additional options. Here is the tone.
When it comes to making stuff at home, I am an expert. I don't want to sound like a braggart, but as far as those hair bows and wooden note card holders go, I could make those for you in my sleep, with my hands tied behind my back, blindfolded. I've always been good at making stuff. When I was 5 years old, I made myself a mom. Using a curling iron, a pink terry cloth bathrobe, 2 packages of marshmallows, and a 1968 nylon-stringed acoustic guitar, I built myself a mom. And this mom was always there to pick me up after school. She sang me Bob Dylan songs every night before bed, and she was always brushing her fingers through my hair and leaving me little notes in my pockets. But best of all, she never made me read the Bible. In fact, we never once had to talk about Jesus and how he was going to make me burn in hell for all of eternity. She was the perfect mom. I made myself a dad to go with her. Using a leather-bound copy of Sun Tzu's The Art of War, a package of Swifties pipe cleaners, a bottle of German sherry, and the tailpipe of a 1965 Ford Mustang, I built a dad who never once, not even indirectly, blamed me for ruining his life. And I built them both at home. Unfortunately, though, there were serious electromagnetic incompatibilities, and one morning I awoke to discover a slag heap of burnt catgut, greasy diagrams of battle formations, and scraps of metal. When I was 12, I made my very own god. Using cereal boxes, extension cords, prescription-strength acne medication, and a giant fuzzy Darth Vader pillow, I built God. But unfortunately, before I could work out all the kinks, I hit puberty, and God was moved to the back burner, on which he burned. But if you want, I can make you another one. Like I said, I can make all sorts of stuff at home, and that's why I've called you tonight. You see, I came across your advertisement at the laundromat. Now, normally, I don't bother with these sorts of things, but well, there was something about your handwriting, something your voice corroborates. You are the prophet for whom this roadside breakdown has been waiting for his whole life. But well, there's just one thing. And it's not the $19.95 plus $5 shipping and handling fee. That is a small pittance considering what you are offering. I look forward to giving you my $19.95 plus $5 shipping and handling fee, for I have no doubt that you will soon have me gunning down the road to home employment in a new car with a full tank of gas. I know that $19.95 plus $5 shipping and handling fee means that you will never let me down, never leave my side. If I need directions, you'll be there, folded up in the glove compartment. And if I ever break down, you will be my triple A. The only thing that bothers me are the hair bows and the wooden note card holders. Now, I understand, of course, that you just can't expect people to buy any old stuff made at home. But I know myself, and hair bows and wooden note card holders are out of the question. I hope you understand. There just has to be something else I can make for you. There's just gotta be. Allow me to say it again. I am very good at making stuff. It shouldn't be difficult for you to help me. In fact, I bet you could do it with your eyes closed, with your hands tied behind your back, in your sleep. A couple of weeks ago, I made myself a penis. Using cottage cheese, a slinky, and a compact hairdryer, I made a penis that puts all those ones you see advertised on the internets to shame. My penis delivers nothing but pleasure. Whenever I go out, it always attracts attention. Everywhere I go, women and men want to touch it. For not only is my penis capable of hitting the G-spot, but it can reach the I-spot as well. At the risk of making you blush, I offer you a demonstration. Anytime you want. Now, I hope you don't get the impression that the computer revolution caught me with my hands down my pants. Far from it. I'm very good with computers. In the past few years, I've made in my home a handheld word processing device, a desktop tower complete with filing cabinets and drawers, and a toilet-top computer capable of generating virtually real bathroom attendants and go-go dancers. I've also designed and implemented a search engine that provides answers to all the really important questions, like, if I win the lottery, will she dump him and come back to me? Can one be homeless and still have sex? Does love even exist outside of the monetary system? Do we have to worry about any of this crap in the afterlife? And if so, do they offer unemployment in the void? Is there anybody out there?
That there's a difference between making a living and making art. It involves immortality.
In fact, I will be immortal.
So you're telling me that a lifetime of pain and suffering is immaterial because when you die, you will be immortal?
I have a chest full of old cassette CDs, my shows. You know, all my life's work is in my drawers, cassettes, CDs.
Uh-huh.
But I'll have to die for them to recognize my genius, and I don't mind.
Yeah, but what if when you die, your landlord comes in and says, "Ah, look at all this garbage," and then takes all your drawers of tape cassettes and dumps them in the street?
I'm going to archive. I have a huge project right now going on with the archiving cassettes. You're on some.
Well, I guess then I have nothing to worry about when it comes to immortality. But here on the mortal plane, Peter, I have some good news. The show is now airing in San Francisco.
And how was it received? Did the people like it?
You know, I've actually already gotten a bunch of really nice emails. But I'm really glad that you asked me that, because everybody else, every single one of my so-called friends, only wants to know something else.
Let me guess. Can I guess?
Sure.
Oh, you're making money now?
Bingo.
Are you obligated to answer that?
I want to answer with my
fists. They're dragging you down. It's just awful that people think that your value is how much money you made. The show is only as good as how much money you made off it. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but what's killing me about this is that all of my friends already know. They already know that the show has nothing to do with money. There is no money. This is public radio. I work at a volunteer radio station. So it's almost like it's a put down.
Ah.
It's like their way of saying, "Oh, you think you're special? Let me remind you how insignificant you are. Let me remind you what a loser you are.
This is what
Let
you
me
to...
remind you
Instead
what
of raging
a
out,
nobody you
ben
are.
Walker, instead of having this kind of rage, I would say that when you get paid for doing art, you know it's going to suck because you are going to be told to make it suck. Water that down. Make that for the masses. We've got focus groups. Don't say that. The opposite is true. If you make money doing art, then you have compromised, sometimes to the degree where you're doing something absolutely the opposite of what you want to.
Yeah, but part of being an adult in society is making compromises. And if you want to do your own thing, then you can't just expect people to, you know, start throwing money at you. And I'm okay with that. I'm 100% okay with this. But what I'm not okay with is people giving me shit.
Okay, here's something to make you less angry. Rage is better than being depressed.
But I'm swinging back and forth between rage and depression. I have both.
Swinging. Right. Rage is... How about no depression, no rage? You know, radio rage and road rage are the same thing. It's the immediate... It's being concerned with the immediate and dwelling on it when it's going to pass. In seconds. It used to be railroad rage. And before that, it used to be walking rage when people would bump into each other. What causes the rage is a comment, like, "Do you make money?" Is a thought, maybe an internal dialogue. But they all pass because you end up getting back to your creative work. And then you feel like yourself again. And that's who you are.
Oh.
That's your food. That's your water.
Uh-oh.
And people... You have that. A lot of people don't even know. They don't have a hobby. Have you met them?
Oh,
people that don't
I've fallen so far. I've fallen so far that I'm taking life advice from Peter Joyce.
And here's another thing. Look, remember that guy that was on PPS? You introduced him to me. He had his books. He was up in his attic just making these crazy wars. But he was voluminous.
You're thinking of Henry Darger.
Yes, Henry Darger.
Henry Darger was a janitor.
It doesn't matter.
I don't want to be a janitor.
See, I've been a janitor. You know what I was doing when I was a janitor? I wasn't being bothered by their data entry. My thoughts were free. I was wearing I had a Walkman on. I was rocking out. I was thinking my own thoughts. I was going to the bathroom a lot. I was high-fiving the other guy. hate thinking. I hate having my brain filled up with corporate thoughts. And that's, I would always get fired if it was one of those jobs that were better paid. You know, the office job? No. For 8 hours, I can't be me. And it's, I can't not be me.
So you're saying maybe I should look into a side job as a janitor?
Okay, I'll tell you my secret. Remember, when you're enraged or if you're depressed, at least you're not married. At least you don't have a relationship of two where she says, you're not listening to me. Because you can have your own thoughts.
Oh,
that should elevate you.
So you're saying I can actually, instead of saying to myself, oh, she picked the guy with the job and not me, and instead of crying, instead of laying face down on the floor every day saying, oh, if only maybe I wasn't a total broke loser, maybe
right.
She would have chosen me instead of him. You're saying I can feel better
about
myself.
You're younger than me. I'll tell you what it is. Instead of being a loser, I am over 15. I wanted to fall in love and get married, and I used to be so depressed. Then I realized it's me that I wouldn't, you know, people, I wouldn't let them get that close. I would not let my lovers, you know, I would let them go if they were serious after about 2 months of fun. And then I would really think, why aren't I in a relationship? Because I value my hobby too much. Every person in a relationship, male or female, says, you don't listen. And I don't.
So, Peter,
I think about the world. I think about Rubia.
Peter, how does one live with a hobby that takes a lot of time to do?
You know the answer already. Do you want to guess? One word. Starts with a D.
Denial.
Disability.
Family thing does seem to be the most difficult balancing act for creative people. Philip K. Dick tried it 5 times. One of his ex-wives, Ann Dick, wrote a memoir about the time she spent with Philip in the 1960s in Point Reyes, California. The book is called The Search for Philip K. Dick, and in a new edition, she writes something really interesting in the afterword. She says, a frequent view of the male writer or artist is that it's difficult for him to function in a bourgeois marriage. The house, the children, the grocery shopping, the car, the bluebirds troop, going to church, going to the beach, birthday parties, the children's colds. But Phil seemed to love all this and used it happily in his writing. Ann Dick still lives in Point Reyes, and so I got her on the phone to ask her about this passage and talk with her about her book and her memories of Philip.
Really, the whole marriage was for the most part, it was a very pleasant relationship with a man who was very entertaining and affectionate and responsive and admiring. He admired me a lot and said flattered me and he was very nice to the children, lovely to the children, and he helped cook, and he mopped the kitchen floor, and he did the dishes. He had some special magic.
Now, the time you guys spent together was a very fertile period for him. Philip wrote 2 of his most famous books, The Man in the High Castle and The 3 Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, but he also wrote countless short stories and about 6 other books as well. How did he find the time?
Yes, it's really amazing, everything that he was doing at that period. He was writing on a regular schedule, 5 days a week, 40 hours a week, 9 to 5, because that's what I wanted him to do. I wanted him to be home for dinner. At the very, very first, he was writing at night, and he'd come home for lunch, and we'd have lunch together. That was quite delightful. And we'd talk about deep philosophical subjects of one kind or another.
Did he ever say, I want to write more?
No, I think he was perfectly happy doing that, and he was doing what he wanted. His idea was to write two novels a year, and then he might write a few short stories, too. But he was keeping to that schedule, and that actually was the same schedule that he'd been on in Berkeley when he was married to Cleo, who was coming out with about two novels a year.
Now, one of the primary themes in Philip K. Dick is that things are not as they appear.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems, Anne, that you almost experienced this for yourself.
Well, you know what I'm thinking about now? He wrote a short story at the as we were getting divorced, or after we got a divorce, about a man who goes to the airport to meet his family, who are, you know, coming in, you know, on an airplane, and he meets them, and it's not his family at all. They're proxers, you know, and the proxers were a metaphor for hostile aliens who inhabited the bodies of human beings. And of course, everything he wrote was autobiography. And I think that's going to be, 100 years from now, that's going to be the most interesting thing to scholars.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, and that's why it's so fascinating talking with you, because so much of, you know, your life in this place and your family and yourself shows up in the books that he's writing at this time.
But it shows up very darkly sometimes, right?
Yeah. But what was it like for you when Phil would ask you to read these books? Can you talk about, for example, what it was like reading Confessions of a Crap Artist, where there's a very dark character pretty much based on you?
Oh, yeah, reading Confessions of a Crap Artist.
Exactly.
Well, we had just come back from getting married, and Philip had been working on this book, and he brought it to me to read. He was really, you know, pleased with himself. He'd finished this book, and here I was the first person to read it, and I was very impressed with myself for that. And here is this portrait of me, sort of me, and not exactly me, that was simply horrible. This woman was just awful. I was stunned. I didn't know what to do with it. So I didn't do anything. I just said, oh, that's a very nice book, or something like that, some dumb thing.
Really?
And went on from there. But it was, I was really surprised. And then later on, I sort of got used to being a dark, horrible female figure.
Well, you do turn up in a number of the books from this period, but you also seem to be responsible for how many of Phil's male characters view their wives.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found it very interesting in your memoir when you talked about how you would sometimes introduce Phil to your friends as Richard, who was your first husband, and you would joke that one husband is the same as another.
I know, that was sort of sad that he got that idea, you know, and I think he got that from that dumb psychiatrist that we went to, who said, oh, Anne, if she wanted a husband, she'd just go out and buy the best one she could, or something like that. And that really stuck in Philip's mind, and he really sort of adopted that as a theory, which was sort of a shame.
You know, it was fascinating to learn that Dr. A, who also shows up in many of Phil's books of the period, was also a real doctor, a real psychiatrist for you both. But the main reason I wanted to talk to you, Anne, was to ask you about something that you write in the afterword to your book. You write, a frequent view of the male writer or artist is that it is difficult for him to function in a bourgeois marriage. The house, the children, the grocery shopping, the car, the bluebirds troop, going to church, going to the beach, birthday parties, the children's colds. But Phil seemed to love all this and used it happily in his writing. And I feel like I'm missing something. I don't understand where you get happily.
Didn't he have a lot of family scenes here and there in his writing? It seems to me he did.
Yeah, but he also has a man who punches his wife for making him go to the grocery store for him.
Yeah, I don't remember that. But
That's in Confessions of a Crap Artist. Remember, for Faye?
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what, one woman that did fascinate me was in that movie, that French movie, Bardo.
Yes, this is the movie based on Confessions of a Crap Artist.
Did you see that?
I did.
Well, here is this good-looking blonde woman, and I love that, you know, sort of being in the movies or being portrayed in the movies or some aspect of myself being portrayed in the movies. That was lots of fun.
Yeah, but I still don't understand why you would say that Phil didn't have a difficulty with trying to balance out the writing and the bourgeois family life.
No, I think he did have it, but he just worked really hard at fulfilling the role of the husband and doing his beloved writing. His writing really was part of his being, or was his being. And I think that he did like the role of the bourgeois husband, but I think it was all too much for him. I don't think he could. I think a man that made a lot of money writing could handle it, you know. But
so you think money was the real problem?
Yeah, and I wasn't the frugal. I was extravagant person rather than frugal, and I'm sure that I wasn't very helpful to Philip in terms of saving every penny and. And, you know, he'd lived at a very, very low financial level before he met me.
Yeah.
I mean, the horse meat level, you know. keeping a middle-class household. I'm writing myself now, and I don't do a bit of housework, and I can see, you know, the picture of the bohemian artist. Why, you have to be. If you get all involved with keeping house all the time, you don't have any time left over or creativity to do anything.
Well, to be fair, I think this is one of the main reasons so many of the male characters in Phil's books from this period are resentful towards their wives.
Yeah, maybe. I didn't quite catch that, but you may be right. You know, I'm not very good at money, so I can't talk about it.
Well, I'm not either, Anne, so we are on the same page. But thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to me.
Okay, bye-bye.
A couple of weeks ago, I got a call from one of the largest Wall Street firms to come up to New York and participate in a special project.
Why would they call you? You don't have anything to do with finance.
Well, I get a lot of calls like this.
Why?
Well, that's how it works. Industry is always interested in plugging in government guys. So that's how I ended up participating in this Wall Street focus group.
You said yes?
Well, it was the night out at Scores.
What?
Yeah, this is what they told me on the phone. Apparently, Scores is where all the new and exotic financial instruments get invented. The, you know, the normal ones, the plain vanilla ones, they get made back at the office. But the really exciting ones are actually made in strip clubs.
So you're saying that Wall Street now has the balls that they can just call up ex-government employees and offer them a free night out on the town at a strip club?
Dude, they won. They all got off scot-free. All the guys that completely imploded the economy, the Justice Department isn't prosecuting any of them. So they have our tax dollars, they have full immunity, and they are ready to party.
So why are they even calling any ex-government employees?
Well, my theory is that, yeah, they won. They got all the money. They can do whatever they want. And they know they're not going to go to jail. But they really hated the finger pointing. They're looking for more friends of friends, I guess.
And now you're signing up to be one of their new friends?
No. Sometimes, when the system fails, it's up to one man to make things right.
Oh, of course. This is about truth and justice. I forgot.
No, payback. I arrive at the club, and I'm just told to, like, give a name to the door people, and they walk me through the club into this back room. And I'm looking around, and there's, you know, strippers and stuff everywhere, and I notice actually a few people that I recognize from DC, but mostly it's Wall Street guys, you know, the Wall Street look. They're walking around with their really expensive shirts and ties with their sleeves rolled up and stuff and smoking cigars and things. So I sit down at this table and I look up at the stage in front of me. There's stages all over the place. There's really really hot chick dancing on stage. And in front of her, like staring at her, you know, inches away from her, is this huge, huge fat guy. Right? This guy's enormous. And this chick is dancing around. She slips out of her G-string, really sexy, you know, it slides down her thighs and down onto the floor. And she steps out of it, picks up the G-string, and then like whips around and wraps the G-string around his neck a couple times and just squeezes the hell out of it. And I'm just like totally freaked out. I'm watching this guy and he's red, he goes from beet red to purple, and he's clutching at the G-string trying to get it off, and then wham, he just collapses on the stage. I'm stunned. I don't know what to do. But then he like gets up, and he's actually got this enormous hard on, and he grabs the girl by the arm, and they just walk off through one of the many doors that are along the back wall. Yeah. So then this Wall Street dude comes over. He tries to like give me a fist pound. And I'm like, what? And he sits down and he points over at the stage and he goes, whoa, hell of a bear squeeze, huh? And I don't even say anything, but I'm kind of like, what? And then he leans in a little bit. He looks at my name tag, which they gave me at the front. He says, oh, you're one of those government guys. You probably don't know about a bear squeeze. A bear squeeze occurs when a share or commodity has been heavily short sold on a strong expectation that it will fall. Instead of which, and he's gesturing to the stage now, it rises.
So, are you...
Remember how I told you that the ordinary financial instruments, the vanilla ones, are created back at the office and the exotic ones are made at the strip club? Well, it turns out they are all based on exotic sex acts. But the interesting thing, you know how on TV when they're trying to explain all these complicated financial instruments and you just cannot understand what the hell is going on? Yeah. Well, this guy, my new Wall Street friend, he just starts showing me around and he's like pointing at these sex acts. And I'm like, oh, now I understand what the long position is. Oh, of course. That's how a naked option works. Ah, come div. I get it. Then another Wall Street dude sits down next to us and he checks out my name tag too. And he also gets really excited that I'm an ex-government guy. He starts talking to me, telling me all about himself. And turns out this guy is a senior executive at one of Wall Street's largest ratings agencies. So clearly these guys are good buddies. You know, they're like high-fiving, they're clinking glasses, and then they start talking about the wife and kids.
Wait a minute, though. I thought there was supposed to be like a separation between the traders and the ratings people.
Are you retarded?
Sorry.
So it turns out that these two guys are responsible for coming up with the credit default swap. Or at least that's what they tell me. So I'm skeptical, but they just stand up and go grab these three girls. They drag them up on stage and they start acting it out for me. This is just too much. I can't watch it anymore. So I get up and I go to the bar. And I'm walking away and I hear the ratings guy scream out, dude, check this out. It's the floating strike look back option. But I do not turn around. I mean, I just can't take it at this point. And I almost left, in fact. I was just about to ditch out on Operation Payback. But then this guy comes up to me and he's like, ah, Mr. Chris, we've been expecting you. I'm so glad you're here.
And who is this guy, Mr. Burns?
Nope, it's the CEO of Gold. So he puts his arm around me and explains to me why he's put on this party. He believes that if he can get the right people to help his people, design the next generation of financial instruments, then if there's ever a problem, and he literally winks at me when he says this. He winks and he says, next time, if there's a problem with the next generation of exotic financial instruments, then maybe there will be less noise. So I put my drink down and I look him directly in the face and I say, well, you're lucky I'm here then, because I have an idea for the next financial instrument that will make everyone here filthy, filthy rich. The whole bar goes quiet. Everyone is staring at us. His eye starts twitching. I turn to the crowd and I say, okay, everyone, I'm going to show you something. It's like the opposite of trickle down. I want you all to pay close attention. This is what I call the money
show. Ah!
What?
I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear about your sick and twisted deviancy.
What are you talking about?
You just said money shot.
Are you some kind of pervert? I punched him.
I went to see my neurologist last Thursday. I've been going to see my neurologist a lot lately, 3 times this past month, which makes my $300 a month health insurance plan almost worth it. It came down to about $100 per doctor's appointment, but every appointment only costs $10 out of pocket, and I don't have to wait more than 2 days to get in to see a doctor. My job does have a cheaper insurance plan, but I checked the wrong box when I signed up for insurance. I've gotten to know my neurologist, Dr. Wilson, pretty well. He has 2 children. He's lived in the same area of Brooklyn for his entire life. He has a neurology-based podcast that he updates once a month. He also has a severe palsy on the left side of his face. When I saw him on Thursday, when he was shining lights into my eyes, poking my face and asking me about my sensations, all I could notice was the small ball bearing taped on his left eyelid. When he pushed against my arms and my legs to check for weakness and asked me to squeeze his hands while looking into his eyes, he kept tilting his head back every 30 or 40 seconds so the ball bearing would shut his eye. It's weird to go through an examination that's basically determining if both sides of your face are working in sync when the person examining you has a broken face himself. It's like the left side of his face gave up. I wonder how many times a day he has to replace the ball bearing after it falls on the ground and rolls away. I wonder how much a tiny ball bearing costs. Can you get them in bulk? If I have a brain tumor, it will be very expensive. My Metro card costs $104 a month. My iPhone costs $90 a month. Sometimes I buy $3 orange juices, and by sometimes, I mean 4 times a week, at least. I eat a lot of sandwiches from Jazzy's, this place near my work, that used to be a nightclub in the 80s. The chicken mozzarella special there costs $6.50, and I go there at least 3 times a week. The teas I get at the coffee place near my apartment cost $1.25. The bar I like charges $6 for beer, and they've never bought me a free round. But getting a brain tumor removed is like more expensive than all of that times 100,000. It'd be like the equivalent of buying new laptops for everyone I've ever met in my life, probably. After I went to the neurologist, after they'd ordered more tests, after they kept asking me if I had family in the area, just in case, I ended up in this bar that was the closest approximation to hell on earth. I bought a $4 tea. They brought out a jar of mint to go along with it. There was a bachelorette party going on in the corner, all the bedazzled ladies smoking and screaming and dancing along. I bet their tab was close to $200 by the end of the night. This man, who looked like a skeleton but was wearing a very lively python-patterned turban, was wailing on a toy keyboard to the beat of a drum machine, like a baby who'd gotten a toy piano at his third birthday. A lot of people were sitting at their computers all over the place, aimlessly chatting on MSN chat, smoking hookah. The couple to my left was silently playing solitaire on each of their phones for over an hour. The woman to my right had a picture of herself as the background image of her laptop. I've been thinking that I might be able to recoup a lot of these expenses if I get a book deal. I've already registered braintumorblog.tumblr.com. It costs $0 for now. Of course, there are a lot of sickness bloggers and cancer tumblers already out there, but I will distinguish myself. I'll wait by the phone for the call to come from the hospital with the results. And when the phone call comes, I'll have a camera on hand. I'll have a friend with a really good camera take pictures of my eyes in low light, when my right pupil is huge in comparison to my left pupil, which is why this whole diagnostic process began in the first place. I'll put an order in for some t-shirts with the image of my head on it. And on the back it'll say, "Of course I'm still at the party," in black sans serif font. None of the proceeds will go to charity, because I will be my own charity. If I leave nothing else on this planet, I want there to be a sticker, a cartoon representation of my head that people will put on the backs of their laptops in silent support of that girl they saw on Tumblr who got that brain tumor, and isn't it sad? And before I go, I'll be a trending topic on New York area Twitter for at least 1 hour of one day.
My dog Laika is a little black cocker with white hair under a nose. She's very old, almost 16 years. She has been with me since I was a teenager and all of my adult life. She's now less hale and hearty. We avoid long walks and running. Otherwise, her heart goes crazy and her body is punished. Sometimes she's paralyzed for days. After a few months of being away, I went to see my mom. When I arrived, I found it strange that my little dog didn't come to see me. As I get closer to the bed, I see her little black hairy body huddled in a pile. I bend over to pet her, but she doesn't react. I try to pull her out from under the bed, but nothing happens. She just moves her head and looks at me with a very demoralized look. The look of a cocker. I take her in my arms and then I try to make her walk, but she's not capable of that. She goes down like a bag of bones. I am in panic. I am so mad at myself for being a bad master. I was gone away too long. I let my dog get old without being there for her, and now she's dying in front of my eyes. I caress her and I try to reassure her, or perhaps myself. I am so scared she will die. And the more this idea becomes real, the more my dog seems to disappear. She becomes a lost dog, an invisible being, untouchable. I make an appointment with the vet the following morning. When we arrive at the vet, my mom tells me, "Please, don't forget. If he asks you too many questions, tell him that she's seen by a vet that is based near our house in the countryside. That is why we haven't brought her recently to him." My mom hates going to this vet because she feels he's looking down on her and is very proactive. He always wants my mom to buy strange medicines and to perform operation on Leica. The first thing the vet tells us is that Leica's teeth are in very bad shape. So mom looks at the floor and says, "Our second vet who takes care of her when we are in the countryside, which is most of the time, told us that we couldn't operate on her mouth because she might not awaken from the anesthetic." "Hmm," he says, but he doesn't look very convinced. I ask him if he thinks her condition is due to a dental infection. "It's very possible," he says. I am terribly ashamed. I should have insisted that he takes care of the problem right now, but I didn't. The vet proposes to do some tests to find the origin of the infection. My dog shakes on the table, but my mom is silent. She hates being judged and people pointing fingers at her. Her sensitivity seems overbearing at times, but I know she's doing her best to take care of my dog. Leica has always been joyful with my mom. And when I compare that situation to my dad, I remember the last time he had her. I visited him while he was in Paris. The dog seemed so taciturn and confused, so I asked about her health. And my father's girlfriend went, "Oh, the poor little doggy doesn't eat anything. She doesn't want her croquettes, and when she eats, she vomits everything. I spent all my time cleaning up after her." In the kitchen, I found a big bag of cat food and pieces of old bread in her dog bowl. My dad prefers buying cat food because it's cheaper. The vet says, "What do you want to do?" Suddenly, she tries to stand up on her four legs and remains like this with an alert look. I don't know how to interpret her gaze, which seems to focus on me. It suddenly connects me to the mystery of life and of thoughts. I have heard that instinct makes a sick dog stand up to fend off potential predators. I imagine my doggy as a prey in a wild landscape. The medicine cabinet, the steel lamp, the chair, and the computer are animated elements, a lush vegetation moving around her. Through her, I can see how threatening, noisy, unstable our environment is. My dog is a mysterious and disturbing double. Our fears, our questioning, our wondering, our resilience are fused together. If she dies, I'll die too. I see my mum and the vet staring at me, waiting for a reply. I say, "I want to keep taking care of her, whatever the cost."
Thank you for calling the Work From Home Hotline. We are currently expanding in your area and are looking for individuals to help with our growth. We are the Work From Home business, the only one with a complete, start-to-finish, proven, advanced, and automated system. Our system works regardless of your background. We provide the system, experience, and hands-on training. The only thing we cannot give you, but is required, is that you have the desire and that you are teachable. We know you have some level of desire because you called. Are you teachable? If you are, we have put together a decision package that will help you decide whether our business is or is not for you. The decision package contains approximately 3 hours of information about our home-based business and begins your training. You will receive a manual that explains how, why, and what we are doing, 2 videos where you will meet us and see exactly how our business works, and an audio cassette tape to further help you with your decision. Your decision package also contains the name and telephone number of your personal team leader, who will be working with you on a daily basis, helping you make money in your first week. Obviously, because there is a cost to us for the materials in your decision package, there is a refundable $36 price for the entire package. The $36 is fully refundable if you decide this is not for you. This package is not how we make money working from home. If you are teachable and truly have the desire and ambition to work, then we will train you and work with you, as others have done with us, to help you secure your financial future. Order your decision package today. When it arrives, review everything thoroughly before calling your personal team leader. We are very excited to begin working with you. Thank you, and have a great day.
After you have finished recording, press the pound sign for additional options. Here is the tone.
When it comes to desire, I am an expert. In my pursuit of desire, I stop at nothing until the object of my desire is safely in my possession, locked away in the basement, handcuffed to the radiator. I hope that doesn't sound too strong, because the other thing I am is teachable. In fact, that's the primary message I'm hoping to get to you tonight. So scratch that bit about the radiator. What I'm really trying to say is I want to be your dog. I want to fetch your paper. I want to pull your bobsled. And I want to spend my nights curled up at your feet. When you say sit, I will stay. And when you shout jump, I will come. I don't want to sound like a braggart, but I've always been a straight A student. Angst. Anxiety, anguish, alienation, agony. But I desire to learn more, and that is why I'm calling you tonight. You see, I came across your advertisement at the laundromat, and normally I don't bother with these sorts of things, but well, there was something about your handwriting, something your voice corroborates. You are the prophet. The mistake I made was assuming you'd come in a more traditional form. I assumed you'd show up wearing a tunic or a turban. I figured you'd have a beard or at least speak in a commanding tone. It really blows my mind to think that all along you've been living here among us, posing as some slob from a two-bit New Jersey town. But that doesn't matter anymore, because I have found you. My dear team leader, I have found you, and I have no doubt that you will soon have me gunning down that road to home employment in a new car with a full tank of gas. I know that you will never let me down, never leave my side. If I need directions, you will be there, folded up in the glove compartment. And if I ever break down, you will be my triple A. But there's just one thing. And it's not the $36. Oh, that is already on its way to you. And personally, I don't care if that's what fuels your business or your coke habit or your child support payments. I just need you to tell me one thing.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Cost of Living. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen, and featured TMI regulars Peter Choice, Laura Mayer, and Chris. Also in the program, you heard Mathilde Bio and Anne Dick. There's more information on the TMI playlist page, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. All that at WFMU.org.
And you are tuned into Mud Up here on WFMU, and I'm joined with a very special guest, Daniel Hernandez, straight in from Mexico City, here on the occasion of his new book, which is called Down and Delirious in Mexico City, the Aztec Metropolis in the 21st Century. How are you doing, Daniel?
Hey, how are you? Good?
Good. What did we hear? You'll be selecting tunes throughout the hour.
Yeah, we heard La Cumbia del Feo, which is a cumbia you might hear at a sonido in Tepito in Mexico City somewhere, sonidero, a street party. We were just trying to determine who actually wrote or made that song, and I think I just got it off of one of those MP3 discs you buy in Tepito for like 10 pesos, like full of just tracks that you play at a street party or a house party or something. La Cumbia del Feo.
Yes. It's great. And I mean, that's when I remember the first time I was in Tepito, it actually kind of blew my mind. The fact that you could get a CD, you know, with 5 hours of music for like a quarter, 25 cents. I was like, man, you know, they're not selling music. They're selling, like, they're making money after the sales of plastic.
Right.
That's how cheap it is. That's
right.
What that economy is.
That's the commodity.
Become.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nuts. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. And it's great to be in this setting, I think, because the book is... It's a book, so it's pages and print, but I think it's also like a visual landscape, and I think it's also like a sonido landscape, audio. It's there's a lot of ears and eyes in it.
Yeah.
So I think playing some songs, it's a good way to get into it.
Perfectly. By way of introduction, you know, I think those who follow the show will know of my, you know, increasing ongoing interest in Mexico City ever since I was first there about 2 or 3 years ago. And it just really, you know, I've traveled, DJed in maybe more than 30 countries, countless cities, and wow. Mexico City was the one to me that I feel like the most addictive, the one mm-hmm. that shocked me the most, the one that I most wanted to return to, the one that I found very frustrating and vexing at times.
Right.
And this book, Daniel Hernandez's Down Lyrics to Mexico City, I felt that out of all the books on Mexico City, this one really kind of communicated that all that energy and attraction that I found.
Yeah.
And you know, the book proceeds, Daniel's taking a look at a lot of kind of like moments of, you know, cultural heat in contemporary Mexico City. And so mm-hmm. look at like the emo subcultures or things going on with the punk rockers or the fashion scene. And it, starting as a kind of an outsider and then mm-hmm. moving
gradually
in, if that's a fair mm-hmm. description.
Yeah, I think it, I didn't realize that process was happening until I was, you know, it hit me one day that I it crossed my mind that I wanted to maybe like hold up a cab because I had no money. and I'm like, man, that is a very local, we might say, nasty stereotype that I've just sort of like clicked on in myself. And for me, that was a moment where I thought, man, maybe I really am sort of getting really, really down here. And it just happened very sort of unexpectedly for me. I was told to go down there and write and explore and see where sort of the road took me, where the doors opened, where they closed, and where I felt out of my boundaries. And that was often. So if I felt out of my boundaries and if I, in a moment, in a place, in a setting, at a location with someone else, and it didn't produce anything immediately for the one who's thinking like a journalist, like a producer of content, like a writer, like someone who effectively connects with people and puts stuff down and gets stuff in, all those moments that were essentially failures eventually turned out to be the most fruitful moments for a study in kind of this long form. You know, so all the times where I felt like I went to this like punk toquin and like a way outer area, outer borough, outer neighborhood, and I didn't talk to no one, and everyone looked at me like I was crazy. But